Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's out right now. And I have Peter Limbo in the studio with me again, and Gary Shea on the other line, New England bass player and extraordinary bass musician, because he's just wrote a book.
And I thought it was extraordinary.
It's going to be extraordinary to write a book after you're playing like crazy. But I have another friend that wrote a bass book too, and because he plays like crazy, even to this day he's on the road. But welcome, Gary, and I just want to say it's a good one to have someone from New England who Peter really liked the band. I have to say that I only saw you guys when you played the channel that one time, but you've been at it since, what, 79? And with that, who did you play in, with you before? Were you playing with anybody before that?
Before New England?
Yeah.
I played some bands in London before that never sort of got off the ground. One was became Detective eventually with Michael Monick from Steppenwolf.
Steppenwolf, yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to high school with John Fannin. Okay.
Oh, there you go.
John was a good guitar player. I was a half-assed one, but...
Right.
We graduated.
Were you an altar boy?
I was an altar. Yes, I was. Yes, indeed.
Cool.
We graduated.
Playing guys.
We graduated together from Zavarian Brothers, and I was always an admirer of John's and the things he did.
John's great.
So now we've got a backbone of a band. It's Gary Shea who's the backbone and the bass. Because I had John McVie when I first started. With the bands, and ever since then, I've had incredible bass players around me. In fact, I had Chuck Rainey come and work with us on Steely Dan albums because I'd had him out with Jeff Beck. He was on that tour, and Walter says to me, he says, ask Chuck play. I says, Chuck plays wonderful. You better get him over there. And next thing I know, we've got him playing on an album. I says, oh, Chuck is playing there. That's cool, you know?
That's great. Yeah.
So we want to hear some stories from you. What about the channel days? What did you come to see some of the groups and stuff to see what was going on?
I also played with Alcatraz.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That was where it was. Yeah. That was
weird. Yeah, it was us and Metal Church and somebody else.
Do you remember the year?
Probably the 86, 87, because Danny Johnson was our third guitarist. He was at that show, and the guy from Capitol Records made us a cake with the album cover on it.
Wow.
It was the Dangerous Games cover with the black jaguar walking across the couch. Like a murder mystery kind of picture. And they made a cake of the album cover and brought it to us. That was kind of cool. That's all I remember of the gig.
I'm not sure I would have been able to...
A bunch of times.
I don't think I would have been able to cut that cake, man. I think I just would have kept that for posterity.
Hey, I had photographs of it for a while. I can't find them.
We used to keep fruit cakes in England for... If you got married, you'd put it away in the cupboard for the next 50 years. And then pull it out. Yeah, because it was a fruitcake. It wouldn't go off.
I've known a few fruitcakes in my life in the music business.
I was waiting for that one.
Yeah. Fruitcake thing.
So let's hear some stories from you from the Channel days, because that's what we're here to talk about.
Well, I mean, when we played the Channel that one time with New England, I think the one time with Alcatraz, because we weren't home. We're usually on the road someplace.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that was what
a lot of people said. We weren't a Boston band because we didn't play there 55 times
a week.
It's like, well, there's other places like Texas and California you got to worry about if you want to, you know, be a national band. Got to get out around the country. So, but I went to see bands. We're trying to come across seeing there.
Yeah, that's
I lived in Brooklyn. I lived in Coolidge Corner for 15 years, right on Beacon Street.
Oh, so you
St. Mary's.
So you did get into the scene then.
I could walk to the Rat and the Katie's right from my house. No big deal.
I'm not sure I would admit that.
In a few minutes. Going to the Rat.
And then you walk to the Rat. Then after the Rat, you walk to the Channel? No. But
yeah.
Because
Channel was too far of a walk.
I was going to say, get in a cab or something. And the Channel after the Rat, a lot of people used to come, you know, after the other venues closed in town, because we were still the latest on in the act. The main act was coming on after midnight anyway. So it was like, you know, let's go and see what's going on at the Channel.
You always got that rush at like 12:15.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of out of the scene, away from, you could get away with more stuff staying open later because on the waterfront, as opposed to being in downtown in Kenmore Square with the lights on. And people saying, hey, you're supposed to be closed. You guys just stay open for a while and keep the party going.
Keep it going and keep it fun, you know?
Well, I'll tell you a weird story about that. One of my cousins was a Boston police officer, and he used to take the Friday or Saturday night duty at the Channel. And he loved it because once the club closed, he would have had a few drinks. I mean, you know, they were known for keeping the lights on sort of until 3 or 4.
Four in the morning,
I have great fondness for the Boston Police Department. They're good guys. I drove cabs for Red Cab for a while. So did Jimmy Waldo.
A Red Cab.
While we were putting New England together, we spent 2 years rehearsing in Braintree and driving cabs at night. And one day I was in Kenmore Square in front of the Rat and decided it was lunchtime where I was going to turn around and go up to Brookline. And I turned around by the bus station right there in Kenmore Square and ran that light. Went around to the next light by Katie's and ran that light and took off up Beacon Street. And I got up by the Art Institute and the cops pulled me over. And they said, where are you going, Shay? Two Irish cops said, hey, Shay, where are you going? I said, I'm going home to have lunch. I go, look, one light's one thing, two's another. Slow down. They let me go.
I like that one light's one thing. That's a good one, that one.
Two's another. Yeah, they let me go, though. That was cool. I had a lot of fun driving cabs, that's for sure, in Boston.
Well, who excited you when you come over to Channel and see people? Who really excited you there and you got off on?
I can't remember. I'm trying to think. There's so many bands.
That's the truth. That's why we're asking everybody. We slowly but surely remember it as people remember their bands and stuff, you know.
Yeah, right. Trying to think like national bands and things. I can't think I saw the Pretenders, but that was the Orpheum. I still went to a lot of shows at the Orpheum, of course, and the Paradise.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think what happened on the waterfront. What did I do?
That's the only place.
Other than play there. It was a great place to play. A great big stage. Love that. Playing parking.
That's what musicians always said about it. It's a great big stage and great
PA,
player.
Of course, was great. You guys ran a great PA, sounded fantastic in there.
We had fun doing that.
Play. And I saw the Atlantics as a band I saw at one point. The Atlantics, remember the Atlantics?
Oh, yeah.
They were a good bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're probably going to talk to Fred Pino.
Fred Pino,
We're going to probably give him a chat to come on here because every one of the guys that Sean McNally knows, like yourself and what have you, I said, let's just have everybody that we can that knows the stuff, that played the stuff, and that's still doing the things. And when I got you on Facebook about you're doing your book for your Facebook and stuff, I says, we've got to get Gary to come on here and have a couple of talks about the times he was there.
Still doing it. In fact, just this weekend, I was in Homosassa Beach on the Gulf of Mexico here in Florida. And I was with Michael Monarch, who, of course, is the guy from Steppenwolf. He played in Born to Be Wild. And he plays on... He plays a couple of clubs each month where he lives there. And he's also in Monsters of Rock. He goes out Ainsley Dunbar and bass player from Steppenwolf. They do corporate parties, and he's been doing that for like 30 years. If you're around the country doing that, you know, you see him play, but they play these big, you know, corporate events that pay big money. But it's, you know, he's playing Ainsley Dunbar, and that's pretty cool.
Ainsley's cool. I worked with him in London in 1973 when we put together an album for Lou Reed called Berlin, and Bob Ezrin was producing, and I did all the production inside with Bob and what have you, and looked after Lou for a long time. But then he wanted different musicians, and I got him Ainsley, I got him Stevie Winwood, I got him BGA Thomas to play on us and stuff like that and what have you as well. And just different musicians came through. And
Ainsley auditioned for Alcatraz.
Well, Ainsley.
Really?
We had it. Yeah. Came down from San Francisco and he just left the Starship.
Yeah, he'd been
out. He came down and he just sounded awesome. I mean.
Oh, he's unbelievable.
But he just wanted to do the. He brought his lawyer, and that was not a good thing. That's not a good sign.
He just wanted to play.
He just wanted to play on the record and take the money and take off.
Yeah,
he didn't want to be in the band, be a band guy, and you know, suffer all the injustices that were about to happen. The rest of the band.
I think when somebody shows up with a lawyer, you know it's time to say goodbye.
It's time to rethink things.
Oh yeah.
And
that's from 79 on, you guys. You guys were on the road for quite a while in the 80s and what have you, following that one.
Just in 1970. Now we did 65 cities in 1970 alone. Wow. Plus we'd recorded the first album, the end of 78 in L.A., London, and Electric Ladyland in New York. It's 65 shows. And we were out with everybody. We were out with Journey, AC/DC, the Kiss Tour. We did shows with Kansas, shows with Styx.
Yep.
Shows are Cheap Trick. We went out with the Outlaws. The first band we ever went up to was the Outlaws. We played Cape Cod Coliseum with those guys.
That's right.
Albany, J.B. Scott's in Albany and a bunch of other places. Oh. And that was cool.
And then later, you get to the Channel, and then it's packed out. All the girls are still going nuts. I'm saying, wow, this is good to see an older band, let's put it that way, then. with the girls that's younger and going nuts because they love the music and the people in the band. They just would go up in as you know, that front stage when you were playing out front and looking at everybody in front, they're all going gulping at you. Oh, you know what I mean?
I get to be in the front of the stage and scope it out. Keyboard guys and the drum guys, horny guys. I'm on the front.
It was just hard getting rid of Fannin, you know, out of the way. They'd kick his ass.
Nah, he was toast. He was a good Catholic boy. He never got in my way. he couldn't believe what we were doing. He would just close his eyes and just go, you guys. But Jim and I called ourselves the Brookline Bombers.
Wow, I like that.
And they were the Braintree guys.
The Braintree.
We put them to bed and continued the party.
That's where it all came from. It's the party.
So we did a lot of running around, had a lot of good times. We were working on our fourth album when the band broke up in 1980. Wow. Beginning of 83.
You know, think about it, man. You know, I look at my own life. I mean, I grew up in Norwood, you know, like I said, went to Severian Brothers, went to college. My parents didn't really have any money, but the music business gave me the chance to see the world, you know. I mean, we all are so freaking lucky, you know. I mean, I spent, I don't know, months in Europe with Mighty Sam McClain. You know, just living a life. I mean, it was crazy. Just
great opportunity.
My friends.
I wanted to put it down and write it.
Yeah, my friends just, you know, they stayed home. They married. In fact, Norwood is the number one place in the country for a man and a female to marry and stay there. Nobody left Norwood, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I get to travel, I get to see the country, I get to see the world, and you just, I look back at it now and I just think, I thank God what a great life I had doing that stuff, you know?
With Peter doing what he's doing, Europe, for you right now with the New England sound, the New England records, the New England stuff that you do would be so big over there because people like Metallica and all those guys and even the ones that came through doing metal and whatever, it's so big in Europe now. You do a festival, you do, it's like Peter said about the when he was with Sam McLean there, they did a festival of 20, 30,000 people, and they would do them all the time and enjoy doing them because the crowd would be going nuts for their songs. They'd sing the damn songs for you. How did they know that?
I mean, Sal Baglio could go out with the Stompers and not open his mouth.
Yeah.
Because the crowd would know every word to every song.
And that's the deal. That's the deal. And when you got that going for you, I know you have with the band New England for WOM.
I used to rehearse in Norwood. I was in a band called Killer Oats before New England.
See, that's where I was at.
I used to play in Katie's. We played the Groggery, Katie's. We played in Somerville, a bunch of other crazy places back then. But that band was a bunch of guys going to Berkeley, and we broke up, and I went to London after that.
Oh.
But I know Norwood. In fact, my friend's father owned the Volkswagen dealership in Norwood.
Really?
Scott something was his last name. Scott. But he had a Volkswagen dealership in Norwood.
Wow.
Yeah, stirring the cobwebs here of my brain.
Yeah, we're going to chat with a gentleman that's still got a place in Norwood that is built a few years ago called the Magic Room, and it's Des Desmond, which you probably know of from the Bentmen and umpteen other bands that played in town and what have you. And his wife, Catherine, and him used to have the museum, the rehearsal hall and stuff in town and what have you. I'm sure every one of you guys has passed because we always seem to find that after we've done this thing, we get a call back saying, I remember them now.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. I was just going to say, you have no idea how many times when I'm driving home from that I think of something so obvious with whoever we spoke to.
Exactly.
I was like, how the hell did I miss that?
Why didn't you say that?
Well, when we walked in here today, I got here a little early and Dink came in and I just said, look, I just want to get one thing straight. I went to high school with John Fannin and I got to at least tell him that because there's my connection, you know.
Right. But John lives down here now in South Carolina.
Does he really? Are you guys still in touch at all?
We still talk to each other.
Well, tell him I sent my regards, if you would, please.
Yeah, we played Japan about 3 years ago. We did a show in Tokyo. We played the Bull Run. We played the Spire down in
Plymouth.
Plymouth.
That's where we are.
I said Portugal.
How did I miss this?
We played in Portugal too, but that was Alcatraz. But,
hey, think of one thing that's great, man. At least you can remember where you played. I represented a lot of acts who couldn't tell you what they did yesterday anymore. So
right.
Consider yourself lucky.
Yeah, I have journals that go back to 1978, since 1978. I'm the history guy for both bands. When they say that Alcatraz play in, you know, Kansas in 1986, and now it was 87. I know. I got it all written down.
It was 86
or 87. In New England, we got sued for $1 million when New England just started to get going. And our lawyer in New York said, "You got any clowns ever write this stuff down? Who says what when?" We said, "No." I said, "You should. You should."
So I
started. So I've got everything written down, all the radio stations, all the gigs. I could go back and say when we did play the channel. I could find a date. I have to go sift through the 80s, but I'd find it eventually.
Well, just think of something. Most of the people I represented couldn't write, so it didn't matter where they had Just kidding, guys.
That's funny.
Yeah,
a lot of guys don't care. I mean, Graham Bonnet's like that. He doesn't know what town he's in. They just got to tell him. Today we're in Des Moines, Iowa, you know?
Hey, think about it. How many times have we been to a show? I mean, people joke about it all the time. But, you know, the front guy goes, "Hey, it's so great to be in Des Moines," or something. And he's in Sheboygan, you know? I mean,
yeah.
You just don't. don't remember where the hell you are.
And that's,
I remember playing with Cheap Trick someplace out in Minnesota or somewhere, and they had at least 8 or 9 huge signs on every monitor that said, "Tonight we are in Duluth." Tonight we are in Duluth. Everywhere on the stage it said, "Tonight we are in Duluth." There was no getting around where we were.
Wow.
And obviously they had the same, every band has that experience.
Well, Cheap Trick blew me away, just not to get off topic for a minute, but we did an outdoor show with them out at UMass Amherst with the Stompers. And I was talking to their guitar tech. They had a Hertz rented truck that was just full of guitars. And Springsteen's bass player and drummer were there because Max's sister went to UMass Amherst and she was a Stompers fan. So they came up to see the show. So we're all talking, and this roadie, this tech, is going through every guitar. Now it's warm out. And he must have had 50 guitars that he was tuning. And I said, "What the hell do you do when you're done?" He goes, "I go right back to the first one and do it all again." I'm like, yeah. I mean, we didn't stay for the show. I would have loved to have seen how many guitars that he actually used, you know, during the show, man. But I have never seen one human being on the road with as many guitars as this.
That many guitars. Well, when I was in New England, I carried 7 basses. I had a case with 3 and a case with 4 slots.
Wow.
7 basses.
Wow.
7 basses.
Mostly just played 1 or 2 of them, but just to kick around with during the afternoon when you're bored. You know, I'd be away from my other guys, so I'd take them with me. Use a couple of basses on, like a Thunderbird for a couple of songs, but not my main thing. So it was kind of luxurious. Now I have 1 travel bass, and that's it. You know, rental amplifiers wherever we go. It's all fly dates.
There you go.
I get whatever I get as far as amplifiers go. And
hey, as long as the volume goes to 10, you're okay. You know?
Yeah, no, I can blow anything up, no problem.
I understand that. Bass has got a good one at that. I blew up a whole bunch.
It's just my middle name. Yeah, just start this watch.
I like that, Gary. Gary, blow up Shay. I love it.
Make this thing suffer.
String its neck and stuff. Oh, no, that's good fun stuff. That's good fun stuff.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the old channel stuff. So when you were driving your car and stuff, you know, the taxi and stuff, did you drop people off there once in a while?
No. No,
it's all in town, Johnny.
Because, you know, it's just right around Brookline, you know, like Harvard Street and Cleveland Circle and all that. At nighttime, mostly just be you guys going to the bars in Kenmore Square and the maids going from South Brookline back down to Roxbury. And they say, "Now, young man, you make sure you lock your doors and you drop me off." And don't worry, lady. Yeah, I know. The cops will say, "You get down Heath Street, just go down there. Yeah. Slow down for the lights and keep going. We're not going to come get you if something goes wrong."
My grandmother lived in the Heath Street Projects. I know it well.
Yeah. Used to go down there all the time. So, but never anybody going out to the channel in the cabs and stuff, because most of those people haven't got money to take a cab. Cabs back then were expensive. I couldn't take one. I drove one.
usually people
had no car, and I took the subway.
Yeah, that's it. And walk across from Chinatown. I knew people that did that a lot, walk across from Chinatown and then try to get back after the show and got all messed up because they were so trashed.
Right.
And stuff like that.
Yeah, and a lot of it was after 1982. What year did the channel close?
1992.
Oh, see, because I left town in 82. That's a big reason I go blank. I came back with Alcatraz, but we were based in Los Angeles. So we were on tour with whatever. And so my recollection of the club only goes up to about 82, 83, when New England broke up and we all went to Los Angeles and started playing with Vinnie Cassano and Vinnie Vincent. And then from there, Jim and I started Alcatraz. And that became our home base for another 15 years of being LA guys. So that's why my memory kind of going blank. Who did I see? I don't remember. I wasn't there. That's part of it.
New
and that's why New England.
You played it New England April 10th, 1982, with the Lifters, and the Dogs. That was what I got on 82 for you. That's with New England and what have you.
That's pretty cool.
Just so you know, Dinky has every show that played the channel and the opening acts, okay?
Right.
Now,
well, I got them all from the Phoenix. I went, spent nearly 2 years just going to the Phoenix when I was a girl trying to get over cancer. And taking all their books out from, you know, the ads and stuff from all the years. And I was copying it on the copying machine. I must have copied out of 2.5 boxes of reams of paper, you know. And and then I put it all in a database for bostonsbestliverock.com. And a lot of people like it because there's also, you know, we put the store up so they can get a T-shirt here and there and this, that, and the other. And and remember memories from that, you know, that kind of stuff and what have you.
Right.
And then we started figuring about when Tony got sick or before he got sick, and then I was sick already. So, hey, let's just go and do this podcast. And then Harry and Peter got this one that they were talking about nothing but something totally different than the club. And it was all talking about people and stuff. And we're talking about you guys having fun and playing and using your minds and using your hands and your drinking like crazy and having a good old time.
Well, we were talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and it, you know, I can remember just going to the channel, like, to meet my lawyer or Howie Cusack, the band's agents.
How we
get more work done on a Friday night at the channel over a couple of drinks than I did all week long sitting in my office at my desk.
It was always like that. It was always like that for you guys. I mean, you know, I mean, that's why musicians like yourself would be in there all the time to sort stuff out, see what people are doing in town, and let's get some ideas and whatever. And also, when you're seeing people like, you know, from the past of, like Roy Orbison, you know, and all the good stuff that used to come through from that era, the 60s and the 70s and stuff that come through. You got all kinds of stuff. And then all of a sudden...
We used to drive up from Connecticut to see bands at the Tea Party, like Humble Pie.
That's the thing. It gets you inspired for what you're going to do next, and then all of a sudden you can say, well, I had that note before, but I know so-and-so did it, and let me just do it even better.
Yeah. And we came up with this, you know, said, I want to play at the Orpheum, and we did that twice. We played once with Nazareth, New England Nazareth, and New England Joe Perry.
Isn't it great? Orpheum. I mean, talk about a kid's dream, right, in your own hometown. I mean, give me a break, you know? It's amazing, you know? I talk to people a lot. You know, like everybody else, I moved on from the music business. But you go back, mostly through Facebook, which is funny, but I reconnect with people, and everybody's got a story, you know?
Everybody.
And it's so cool. I mean, my wife now was not involved at all in the music business, and she's getting off on all of this stuff. I mean, she sat through my interview with Dinky and Tony, and I said to myself, this is going to lead me to freaking divorce court on the way home. I could just sense this coming.
Right.
And she had a freaking blast. I mean, we were almost together for 3 hours, Dink, remember?
Yeah.
Right. And I was like, you know, and again.
Peter, were you friends with Rick Aliberti and Ron Pennell, all those guys?
Oh, yeah, Ron did all my photographs. He did all my pictures and stuff, sure.
I know we met way back then. I know your name. I definitely recall your name.
Well, I managed the Stompers. I managed Fahrenheit. Right. I managed Daryl Martini, the Cosmic Muffin. Bobby Whitlock from Derek and the Dominoes. And Mighty Sam McClain a little later on, who was a blues gospel singer. Right. So that's kind of, you know, I spent...
Yeah, same group of people, the scene. I mean, that's cool. Ron did a lot of our stuff, too.
Ron,
photography-wise.
Ron was terrific. I just...
Yeah.
And I know a lot of younger guys came along, and you know, but Ron, to me, He just took.
You get all that Led Zeppelin photos.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Like
I mean,
Nugent covers and Aerosmith.
You just look at his resume, man, and it scares the hell out of me. He was so good.
And he had fun doing it. That's the most important thing about it. That's why some of the stuff that I've seen is captured.
Some of the best pictures that he took of my acts were done like he's got one more photograph on his roll, you know?
Right.
And he'd say, all right, guys, just walk around, do this, do that. And that turned out to be the promo shot because it was just so freaking natural, you know?
Right.
I mean, we, for the Stompers press picture, when they signed to Boardwalk, we used a picture from the dressing room of the Paradise that was, nobody was paying attention. And he just, he said something, everybody looked, he snapped the photograph, it was the last picture on the roll, and that became the promo picture. I mean, it was wild. Yeah.
It's because it's real.
You can't try hard in photography.
Exactly right, man.
He had a real good friend, a young assistant named Paul McAlpine.
Oh, yeah.
A little photographer, too. Yeah. He took a lot of our stuff.
I remember him as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I almost got married to one of Ron's friends.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Wow.
That went on for about the whole time when I was knowing him, about 3 years. And we broke up. The band broke up kind of the same time. And off he went to Los Angeles.
So when you look back, I mean, this is just a curiosity question. You know, when you look back, did you have a great life in this business?
Silence is golden.
What's that?
Did you get that one?
No, and here we go.
Oh, I just asked you, if you look back at your music life,
right?
You know, do you remember a good life? Do you remember a hard life? I mean, you know, when you look back, what do you think?
Oh, I definitely worked hard to do what we're doing, but it was good work, and we had a great time. I'm very fortunate, and I always say, you know, I may not have come out of the whole thing really rich with 12 cars and 5 houses, but you know, I got a nice house in Florida, a nice car, and I've done, I don't know, 27 albums or something like that. I've done around the world.
27.
I just got done.
That's great.
Yeah, Alcatraz. We're still playing. We just did. What did we do? We did 9 countries in Europe just recently.
That's amazing.
We did 16 shows in 9 countries in 19 days.
Wow.
Oh, that's good stuff. I like that.
Portugal, Switzerland, Luxembourg, whole 9 yards. And then, you know, the UK playing down the Midlands and all that stuff and playing Edinburgh, Wales. So, yeah, I'm still doing that. I'm in my 70s, and we're still playing.
That's great, man.
That's a great thing.
Year. We're gearing up for August for it'll be the 7th Alcatraz studio. It'll be coming out sometime next Christmas.
That's what I mean. In Europe, you're going to go nuts off because they love that kind of style of music and stuff.
I mean, when I was younger, the idea of going to Europe for me was – like, that's never going to happen. I mean, when am I going to? I didn't really have any money, you know.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, one of my clients becomes more popular in Europe, Sam McLean, than he was here. And he's doing festivals in freaking Europe, you know.
That's what I mean. That's the good
stuff.
All
of a sudden, your life changes. I mean, it's wild.
I've done it in the 60s and I did it in the 70s. But then later on, I did it in the 90s with a reggae group called In the Circle. Took them to Europe, and we had a number one hit there with Sweat All Along, not just Bad Boys. Bad Boys was a hit here, and then Sweat All Along. But the shows, the people came out, every note, they knew every damn word. They're singing along, the whole place is singing, there's beer in the air, there's this in there.
Yeah.
We actually woke people up at 8 o'clock in the morning in Switzerland in one of them big festivals there, you know, that was starts at 8, people were sleeping all night. Well, I started hitting the really big syndrome stuff, the electronic drum thing, and woke the heck out of them, and next thing you know, bad boys, ha-ha, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, I thought it was great. We just had a great old time. And
yeah, Jimmy and I are amazed. We go to Tokyo someplace, and there's New England elms.
Yeah, that's Osaka, they love Nagoya, it.
They're in Switzerland, they pull up all kinds of New England stuff I haven't even seen. Blue vinyl, green vinyl. Where'd you get this? I'm in a band. I don't have one of these.
But you don't have the cassettes. The cassettes in Japan are ridiculously expensive. Yeah. And especially
I've got eight tracks of New England and just all the cassettes.
Wow!
I'd sell them in Japan for hundreds of dollars.
Because that's
what they charge for a cassette from right. that time period. It's all right. historic and it's classic now.
Right. I'll tell you,
Jimmy and I were just driving around Europe this last summer, and we were talking about Frankie Melga at Acadia's house. We suck. We didn't play Rolling Stones and Brown Sugar. He was in a band called Fatback with John Fan, and I was in a band called Killer Oats with Berkeley guys. We were playing Mahavishnu stuff or trying to play Mahavishnu stuff.
I did Mahavishnu.
Allie might tell us. I said, we don't want to be a jukebox band. I want to be the guy on the jukebox. That was my whole thing.
There you go.
When I started off in high school was to play original music, heavy stuff like The Who. No wimpy stuff, no flannel shirts and acoustic guitars and all that stuff. I want some heavy, heavy-duty rock.
You can blame me for Mahavishnu.
You know, it's funny. I became friends with Gary U.S. Barnes, you know, Quarter to Three and
right.
Twist yeah. Fist and all those songs from the 60s. He lived on Long Island, and our engineer, Glenn Kulakin, who engineered the Stompers' first record down there in Syosset, brought him in, and he was just... He was the most partiest guy at his age I ever saw in my life. I mean, he ended up falling asleep in my hotel room floor and stayed there all night. He was all cold. But anyways, he told a story about going into a record store somewhere and seeing one of his albums, which he didn't have. And he went, oh, my God, I don't have this record. And so he went up to the register with a $20 bill because it was $15. And the guy goes, excuse me, sir, that's $150 for this. and he went, wait a minute, $150? I'm that guy on the cover.
Right.
And the guy goes, who are you? He goes, Gary, I'm Gary U.S. Barnes. That's my record. How can it be $150? Right. It didn't cost $150 to make. We recorded it in my garage, which was true.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he pulls out his ID, and his real name was Gary Alexander, and the guy never believed him. And I said, I said to him, did you buy the record? He goes, hell no. I'm not paying $150 for a record I made.
I went to a Kiss convention in Detroit with a friend of mine. It was a record convention, not a Kiss thing. It was a record convention, a big one, you know, like 100 vendors and stuff.
Yep.
And I came across a live someplace Alcatraz CD. And it was $20, and it was some bootleg bull-only thing. And I said, I'm going to get it. So I paid for it. I didn't tell the guy that I'm in Alcatraz. I didn't say a word to the guy that was selling it. I gave him $20. And the funny part was we were walking away, and this older man security guy came up to me and my friend. He goes, excuse me, sir, but did you pay for that? He thought maybe I just shoplifted the CD. And I said, mister, I paid for this in blood.
That's a good
one. Yes, I paid for it.
What a great line.
Yes,
what a great line.
In blood, mister. And he went, oh, okay. He had no idea what I was talking about. This old guy trying to do
that's hilarious.
Job, you know?
That's hilarious.
Shoplifting the stupid thing. And all they say, it's a piece of junk some asshole recorded with a, you know, it's like dog shit, I'm sure.
So you said earlier that you were trying to play a lot of the Mahavishnu stuff and whatever, the fusion. I'm the guy that worked with Mahavishnu from 1972 through 73, through 74, all the way through until even the second band.
Right.
And the first band was amazing live. But, you know, if you're going to listen to note by note, you've got to hear something like that. It's just definitely.
Oh, yeah. You know. Those guys, Weather Report, there's some great stuff. And especially with Berkeley being, there's all kinds of great players. And that's why I went to Boston rather than going down to New York City. I grew up in Connecticut. I want to go to Boston.
Yeah.
And then I always wanted to go to England. And then when the draft got over with, when Nixon got out of Vietnam and all that. I said, now I'm free to go to England. So I packed up my stuff, and I was living in Coolidge Corner, a bunch of guys, had a real nice house right off of Harvard Street, and put the whole thing down. I said, I can always get another apartment. I can always come back. They said, you're crazy. I said, I'm going to go by myself. I got an airplane. I went, and I wound up at a party that night with the Pink Fairies and the MC5.
Wow.
Best party. Pink and off Fair. I went, you know. And
I love it.
I met Michael Corby, who started the Babies. He wanted me to be in the Babies, and I said no. And then I filtered through a bunch of other things and wound up with, like I was saying, Michael from Steppenwolf, and hanging out with Luther Groza from Spooky Tooth and recording at his house doing demos with those guys, and wound up with Peter French, who was in Cactus. And they had just broken up because Carmine and Tim Bogart were going to join Jeff Beck. So Peter came back to England and joined a band. I had to add Melody Maker for a singer. And it was me and Herman Rubel, who eventually joined the Scorpions, a guitar player from New York. And then Herman and I got kicked out of the country for visa problems, and I came back to the States. And that's when I met John Fan and Jimmy and Hirsch. It was after that point.
That was
they thought I was making all this stuff up. I don't think they believe me. That I was talking, hanging out, you know, staying at Luther's house and doing all these things. I don't think they believe me, but the truth is stranger than fiction.
There always, you go, man.
Always. On that note, we're going to have to call it on this one because it's time up for us. And but the thing is this is fun stuff because the story is that it's not just channel-oriented, but Gary Shea-oriented in his life. It's good stuff. I mean, we can't grumble at any of it. I mean, and you got to keep going. That's what we want you to do is because that's the
thing. Yeah.
I'm in my 70s, not well at all, but if I don't keep going with the mind on this stuff, I wouldn't be here. I know that for a fact. Right. I'm enjoying reminiscing in a lot of ways and having people around me that is the same as me, that wants to do that same thing and have a good time.
And, you know, it's different as we all are and were.
Yeah.
We all have similar stories.
Oh, all of us.
I've done, five or six of these things, and it's amazing to think about.
That's like a brotherhood.
Exactly. That is the word, my friend.
That is the word. Thank you, Gary, we're going to use that one.
You know, musicians I've met, you know, a thousand guys around the country, overseas, playing bands. That's why my book, No Bass, No Party, is out right now. It's all about, you know, being in high school and getting a guitar and getting kicked out of high school in Connecticut saying, we're going to play Madison Square Garden. Well, we did twice.
That's awesome. That's the thing. That's what we love. We love that stuff. Peter and I just all of it. All right, Gary.
Hey, say hi to John for me if you talk to him, will you, please?
I will do that. It's great talking to Peter. Thank you. Great.
It's great. Listen,
remember,
thank
no
you.
No bass, no party. Without the bass, there's no funk. There's no party without the bass.
That's the daddy be truth. Thank you, and thank you very, 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 very much, Gary Shea, on Two Pints in a Corner. We'll be now closing out.
Cheers.
Cheers, man.
Take care, man.
Thank you.
This was great.
Thank you, Gary. That was great. Thank you very much.
Okay, guys.
Have a good one.
Talk to you again soon.
Yep. Definitely. Bye.
Take care.